sometimes when I'm in certain frames of mind, particularly on very hot days around the North Circular, I can feel time radiating off of pre-moulded concrete lintels.
Welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography with John Rogers and Nick Papadimitriou. This is a show that looks at the rich tradition of early 20th century topographical walking guides to London and the South East and what use they might be to us today.
They're kind of like inlet valves for some unmediated cosmic energy.
Each week, we'll be taking a trip through the pages of a different book as if we are on a wayward topographical ramble.
Because I know they're actually just technology, they're applied machinery, but they seem to me almost to be kind of like storage vats of regional memory.
Hello, and welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, John Rogers, and my co-host, Nick Papadimitriou. This is a show that explores the world of early 20th century walking guides to London and the South East.
And today we'll be taking a derive through the London Perambulator by James Bone, published in 1925.
James Bone, author of The Perambulator in Edinburgh. The London Perambulator. What a bounteous banquet of costly viands is spread before an ardent-minded, grateful-spirited perambulator. Old Humphrey's Walks in London. With pictures by Muirhead Bone. One November afternoon, a child was looking out of the window in my Temple attic. Suddenly she asked, "Whose keys are those on your tree?" "Those are the keys of London." One likes to suppose that there could be such keys, keys to unlock the heart of London. How invaluable to a topographer of her moods and secrets. But failing such keys, one must perambulate early and late in all weathers to know a little about London. No one can know much more than a little about London.
That was a reading by Hayley LePayne from the London Perambulator by James Bone with music by Yevgeny Grinko. The first thing I think we probably must say about this book, Nick, is it gave us the title to the film that I made about you.
That's right, John. And it's a considerable source of embarrassment to me, in a sense, because I don't know London at all well. I don't see myself so much as a London perambulator as a stockbroker belt Heideggerian, really. Nevertheless, I must thank you for introducing me to this book. Prior to making this series, I didn't actually have a copy, and you very kindly picked up one for me. And it's a jolly good read, actually.
It wasn't the most obvious book to choose in terms of content for the title of the film about Nick. That film is obviously called The London Perambulator, and it is screening at the Brighton Film Festival, which is called Cine City, tomorrow, if you're listening to this show, on Wednesday the 26th, I think it'll be. I think the film screens, no, 25th, Wednesday the 25th, and the screening will be on the 26th at Brighton at the Salis Benny Theatre on the Grand Parade. But the reason I think I chose it as the title was because you very much, your practice of deep topography and what I was looking for in a film was to make a film that sort of captured the spirit and the mood of place, which wasn't so easy to pin down. And that's what I think this book is about, unlike a lot of the other books we'll feature in this series, which are, some of them are a little bit more prescriptive in how to experience the city. This is a bit more oblique, don't you think, Nick?
Oh, yeah. James Bone wanders around and absorbs the city. It kind of like tunnels into him and generates a lot of turmoil in him that I think is evident in the writing. That was the impression I have. And for James Bone, the city is a dark place and a place that's kind of quite hard to pin down and locate. So that although he often describes particularities of the city, tobacco shops or individuals in cafes, etc., the overall sense you get of the city is as an ill-defined place, something that is far larger than him or his capability to express it.
OK, what I'm going to do, actually, is play a little clip from the film, an audio clip from the film, which demonstrates, I think, sort of the crossover between the themes of the book and the themes of the film. And then I think probably from that, we'll go straight into another reading from Bone, from the introduction. Again, so let's go from you, and the first, actually, initially, from Will Self.
And in the 80s, I was very interested in interzones, what I called interzones after the Burrosian term. I was really very interested, and Nick was as well, in liminal places, places that existed, you know, particularly the border between the urban and the rural, or Rus in Urb, or Urb in Rus, you know, those kind of, you know, sort of, which, so that, so in a way, those three states are all aspects of each other. Back in the 80s, I remember walking within places like Erith Marsh, now gone, sadly. I mean, now somewhat ironically in terms of Nick's history, where they put Belmarsh Prison. But at that time, perhaps the last redoubt of kind of serious Rus in Urb that was that far into inner London.
So now here we are to the north of the course of the river, and if you look over here, you can really see the shape of a substantial gully forming. In fact, we're looking across a mini river valley towards the far side. When I first saw that, or first noticed it, I should say, a couple of years ago, I was absolutely astonished. I felt as if I was time travelling. I felt I was looking back into, you know, the pre-World War I era. I could suddenly see the rural, if you like, shape of the land. Something that's just screened out by modern sensibility. Very powerful experience. It's kind of portal or window through to other possibilities that are embedded in the landscape.
Chapter 1, The Face of London. London! It has the sound of distant thunder. Only one other great capital has its might reverberating in its name. Rome. Roma, however you say it, sounds like the shout of legions or long waves breaking on the shore. London, with its equipoise of syllables, seems to hold its power, to impend, almost to threaten. To some it sounds like a warning, to some like applause, but always distant, distant. How the name rolls over the country, calling up the recruits. And how did it sound in alien ears, to the generation of exiles who have sought shelter here through the ages? The Dutch refugees who were given the Church of Austin Friars, the Huguenots driven out by the Catholics, the Catholic emigres fleeing from the revolutionaries, the communists fleeing from the republicans, all to settle and mingle in Soho, the Italian liberators, the Russian revolutionaries fleeing from the Tsarists in turn fleeing from the Bolsheviki, then the coming of the refugee Belgians in their thousands. To them all the growl of London must have softened to a purr.
Again, that was reading by Hayley Le Payne from the introduction to The London Perambulator by James Bone. I suppose with these books, there's always a question of who were these people, because they're not celebrity authors. They're often not very celebrated authors. You don't get a great deal if you Google them. I rang Jonathan Cape Publishers, who published the first editions of The London Perambulator, to ask them if they knew anything about James Bone. Didn't, but they did know a lot about his brother, Muirhead Bone, who illustrates the books, which is an echo of Gordon S. Maxwell, who had his books illustrated by his brother, Donald Maxwell. And Muirhead Bone became quite a sort of esteemed artist in his day. He ended up being a trustee of the Tate and the National Galleries. He was a member of the New English Art Club with Walter Sicker. It was also the official artist on the Western Front between 1916 and 1918. And it seems that James Bone was a journalist for The Guardian, was a Glaswegian, and wrote this book after being in London for 24 years. And it was sort of like a summation of his impressions of London after 24 years.
The thing that really interests me about James Bone reading the book and seeing him in the landscape is that although he describes his impressions and to some degree his emotional responses to the city, it's actually the city itself that's always primary in his writing. He's not got that kind of like sense of his own complex inner universe, such as we associate with more contemporary urban writers, such as Ian Sinclair, or, you know, just many of the people who pass as psychogeographers, or indeed probably you and I, insofar as we write about the city. He's there as a soft tympanic membrane vibrating in response to the city. But in a sense, that's all he is. He doesn't tell anything about his biographical circumstances.
No, that's true. That's true. I don't think, do any of the authors we're talking about in this series on early 20th century walking guides talk about themselves much? Does Maxwell? I don't think he does he? Pathfinder?
That's a very stridently phrased question, John. I suppose you've got me stumped there, but it strikes me specifically in this case because there is something about the way that Bone relates to the city that I don't find in Donald Maxwell, Gordon S. Maxwell, and certainly not in Pathfinder, because Pathfinder was out in Stockbroker Belt most of the time. There's an amorphous crossover between Bone's reality and the city.
Yeah.
They bleed into each other in a way that is frequently quite disturbing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that one of the things with this book, and one of the things I liked about it when I first picked it up, was that it reminded me of Peter Ackroyd a little bit, actually, because the way the chapters aren't based on areas, they're based on moods and themes. I mean, the chapter we're going to talk about later on when we do a walk around Euston is the most sort of clearly geographically defined chapter in the book, I think. I mean, other chapters in the book, he does talk about the Inns of Court, actually, because he lived in Temple, so he talks about the Inns of Court. But he talks about things like barges and watermen and the London calendar, the way that the city changes with the seasons and the different things that happen in the different seasons in the city, which I sort of think makes him quite contemporary in a way. I might be wrong about that. I mean, we'll probably have to agree to differ.
But he definitely displays a whole battery of techniques for defamiliarising the city so that he can see it new in its true light, possibly. He breaks out of the codified set of arrangements that we have in our relationship with the city. He doesn't describe himself going to work or shopping. He's always a stranger drifting into landscapes and looking at them. He has a variety of techniques. He approaches streets from the back. There's that beautiful bit where he describes Waterloo Bridge and the monkeys hanging off of ropes from the backs of the buildings.
Yeah.
He has an eye for hyper-particularities, such as the... what's the language that he says that you can learn from a magazine outside Fenchurch Street Station?
Oh, Malay.
Malay.
Yeah.
That's lovely. But he also has a way of looking at the city under the aspect of eternity and seeing it as a shimmering dream that may dissolve at any point. There's this rather beautiful piece when he's writing on the artist Turner. He says, in the wide reaches of the river at night, he found the silence and space amidst the complicated and resounding town that his exasperated nature sought. And into these nocturnes he has imparted a strange tension of beauty, as though at any moment something might snap and the chartered Thames and its warehouses and lights along the banks might suddenly not be there, only a wide nameless creek with forests at its swampy side swooning under the night.
Wow. Poetic. Very poetic. I sort of feel as well like Pathfinder was a journalist and Bone is. We're not sure about Maxwell, probably was a journalist. And in some sense, you get a feeling that they were letting loose a little bit with these books. They took quite a journalistic premise of, I'll write a book about London or I'll write a book about walks, but then they sort of went off on flights of fancy and really sort of allowed their prose to flow. Should we say something about the etchings in the book? Because they would have been a big part of the book when it was sold. I can't help feeling that this book would have partly been sold on the basis of Muirhead Bone's involvement, who was quite well known. What have you observed, Nick, in those etchings?
I find them out of sync with the rest of the book, time-wise. Many of them... There's no cars, for instance, in any of the illustrations.
Oh, you're right.
And the characters in the various cityscapes that are depicted are wearing what looks to me like Edwardian dress. The men are wearing straw boaters and blazers. The women have long dresses and parasols. And there's lots of hansom cabs and the like in the distance. In fact, the car doesn't particularly get into the book at all until the end, where there's that section on viewing London from roads and from the air. Rather wonderful piece, by the way. And I can't help feeling disappointed at your choice of chapter for where we went with this book. I would have loved to have flown over London in a bomber, as James Bone describes in that chapter.
Difficult to organise. I did try. I did try. We did find a man that had a wing of a bomber, but you do sort of need the rest of the plane, I believe. We did a walk, didn't we? Let's talk about the walk, because we did a walk the other night. As we do each week, we take a chapter from the book and we go out and walk it and we observe whatever we observe, really. This one was actually probably a lot less planned than some of the other walks, wasn't it? I think we just really did.
I think we can safely say that, yes.
Yeah, we sort of... Which I think that's why I bullied Nick into using the word derive at the beginning of the show. He hates that expression. But it probably was the nearest thing we've done to a sort of, I don't know, maybe what you might call a neo-psychogeographic drift, if you like, whether Guy Debord would recognise it as a... to Reeve, I'm not entirely sure, but we did the walk on the area north of Euston, which he describes, which I think is a lovely chapter. It was always my favourite chapter, not because when I got the book, I lived near there. I used to live at the top of Pentonville Road, you know, at the Angel, but just the way he describes the area, you know, he talks about it being a queer region with a population that moves much at night. Not when we were there, though, actually, the other night, but... And he talks about it being sort of furtive and sinister, have a furtive, sinister spirit. And the stations are surrounded by a kind of debatable land. Mm. Sort of reminded me a little bit of Ian Sinclair. Should we play a little bit of that reading? Mm-hmm. And then what we'll do is go straight into the other night when we went for a walk north of Euston. So I'll just play this little reading again by the wonderful Hayley Le Pains.
The emanation thickens to a cloud in the region behind the three great termini in Euston Road that may be called, for convenience sake, North of Euston. King's Cross lurks within a sort of stable yard, its campanile with the clock, too, having a domestic look, like the feature of a stable of a great house. It seems the right place for the Flying Scotsman to bear away in reserved compartments carefully selected people on the 11th of August. St. Pancras is like a cathedral to an unknown saint, called St. Pancras for the moment, raising the whole skyline of the north with Gothic outlines and its nobly spanned interior, whose great height reduces trains and people to something like performing mice in a cage. But best of all, as a work of imagination, is Euston, with its tremendous granite Doric portal by which Hardwick recognised Euston as London's gate. How the lights of London sparkled in the old days as one drove through it in one's first London hansom. How its shadow fell as one drove back. What a setting was the gigantic portal to the dreams of young men who'd come to London to seek their fortune. Does not suggest the young man seeking his fortune at all. All great railway stations surround themselves with a sort of debatable land that is neither residential, commercial, industrial, trading, nor theatrical. It has shabby hotels and makeshift lodgings, bawdy houses, pawnbroker's shops, second-hand dealers in all sorts of articles from muddy mock ermine furs to rings of rusty keys. A strange temporary look hangs about the place, as though the denizens were always packing up, many of them moving on, and moving on too quickly to pack up, and the place was organised for immediate disposal of their goods. The only touch of new paint is where a new pseudonym has been lettered on the front of a shabby hotel. A strange sort of conflict seems to be waging all the time up and down these streets, with routs and forays as though London was defending itself against these adventurers and trying to drive them back into the stations and away, and the needy folk were making a last stand.
I think maybe the Crescent is one of the first places we should try and find.
I wondered if it was that.
Well, I thought it might be on the other side there. I thought it might be Drummond Crescent.
That's right, yeah. There's a lovely old bookshop there, isn't there?
Is there?
Yeah. Oh, no, it's that one I'm thinking of, I think. I'm not sure which one.
Should we go and find Drummond Crescent?
No, I think we should go north of the station.
Do you?
Yeah.
I think because a lot of it he actually talks about is... A lot of the area he talks about is Summers... We'd now call Summerstown. And I think that Crescent is Drummond Crescent. Should we go up along Evershot Street, north?
Oh, is that not on the other side of the road, Drummond Crescent?
No, it's this side.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah, it's sort of north. It's north of the old station.
Okay, fine, yeah. I think so. There's a sort of overlap to some degree with Harold P. Klum's London, in the sense that you get the city as being this Portland stone edifice with a flow of people rushing through it.
Yeah.
And people are rendered relatively anonymous by the overbearing presence of the city. But in another way, he's very different to Klum. Klum is far more into civic pride and declaring the grandeur of London as a great global capital. Whereas I feel that although Bone bemoans the fact that London has been let down in its role as a great capital, he actually is in a way quite relieved because he likes the gothic dark city that he describes.
That's great. We're walking past Secret's table dancing club, lap dancing club, and I love the way Bone talks about the bawdy houses in the area around. I suppose by bawdy houses he must have meant brothels, mustn't he?
Guess so.
And then this street here, we've got Secret's Lap Dancing Club. This is on Evershot Street. Then Euston Bookshop, which was a sex shop.
Then William Hill's betting office, and then an off licence.
Yeah, because he talks about...
You've got everything you need.
He talks about pawnbrokers, doesn't he, as well, and shabby boarding houses. And then it's alleyway now.
This is one of my sewer theories. They got the car park there because the sewer can run right down underneath it, under the road and through here.
So you think this might be we're walking along the sewer?
Why? It's probably a sort of relative trunk sewer, you know, not an absolute top-notch one, but there you go. That would suggest also.
Oh, yeah.
I find urban alleyways are invariably doubling as sewers, or occasionally they cover over original streams, and perhaps streams that have been incorporated into the stormwater or sewage system.
There you go, look.
Yeah.
Well done, Mr. Pachtimitri. You're like a sort of water diviner, but for sewage.
I've got the empathy with rivers, and then it runs straight down the street, but it looks like the street drops here. So what goes on? Although I always get this sense of footsteps following me when I walk along here. Ghostly footsteps. Makes me really nervous.
Does it?
Yeah.
That's what Bone talks about in the London.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I haven't read it.
In the Crescent. In the Crescent where he says the murder took place.
I can hear it now.
Which is kind of weird. That's frustrating in that chapter. He talks about this notable... famous murder of a very great thinker, he says, but he doesn't give the name. Why not give the name?
And he says that shame and tragedy followed. Yeah. But what was the shame and what was the tragedy? And then there's this curious story of how the murderer's finger is found impaled.
No, that's a pickpocket's finger.
No, he's prosecuted for the murder.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. They find his thumb, I think it is,
yeah,
on the spike, and then he's arrested for pickpocketing a couple of days later.
In the Elephant and Castle.
In the Elephant and Castle. And they take the fingerprint from the thumb.
It's quite funny, isn't it, that he was out pickpocketing a week after he'd lost his thumb or his finger. And they were sort of going, how can you pickpocket with your hand in the stakes? He just roughly bandaged it up himself.
And what's interesting is they say, he says, what it is they charge him with pickpocketing, and he shows his hand without the thumb and says, how can I be pickpocketing without a thumb?
That's it.
And the police look at it and say, hello, this might be our guy.
Yeah.
I'm a bit lost now. Isn't it funny? I used to hang around here, and I remember rather nice, I think they were Victorian buildings with wrought iron balconies. And things.
Yes.
I think they've all gone.
You know what they're in as well? With this area here with this gasometer and stuff. Well, the gas, not a gas. Yeah, it is a gasometer there, isn't it? that is
It's in Mike Lee's High Hopes. That's where the couple in High Hopes live, in one of those flats you're talking about.
Here's King's Cross, look. And here's St Pancras.
Station?
Yeah.
Well, it's a lovely side effect of the redevelopment, in a way, is that it's opened this view up, which is an amazing view of London with the twinkling... lights in the sky, the planes coming into land.
And the
cranes.
Land is so low-lying here that the minor hump of the road gives us a great, almost aerial view across the back of the stations.
Yeah. That area we now know, we looked up and we went back home because we didn't like. I had the London Compendium in my bag, which is an invaluable guide to walking London. Not most of the walks that we do, actually, because most of the walks we do aren't really in what is considered by some people to be London, but around King's Cross or central London, Eglinton's London Compendium is an invaluable guide. But when I got home, I looked up that location because it is such a strong place, isn't it? Such a strong image. If you've seen the Mike Lee film High Hopes, if you haven't, do, because it's a brilliant film. But all those streets there around Stanley Passage was the street that the flat in the film was in. That they've all been knocked down now. Which, when we were talking about at the time, it is interesting that it's now given us that view around King's Cross, hasn't it, that wasn't there before.
That's right. What perturbed me that evening we went walking was how lost I felt. It's a source of considerable embarrassment to me that, in fact, I don't really know my way around London at all well. And it's quite ironic that I grew up in the suburbs of London and you grew up in Buckinghamshire. You know your way around London a lot better than I do.
I think that's typical, though, isn't it?
It's often warned about in the books that we've been looking at week by week. Londoners don't know London. And I think partly the St Pancras development has disorientated things. But I've never really known my way around there that well. And I was most impressed with your knowledge of the area, as well as humiliated and highly irritated.
Well, I used to live up the road, so I used to walk around there quite a lot. And I think it's something we talked about on the night was, you know, a lot of the time with walking areas, particularly walking redeveloped areas, you know, that's our way of coping with change in a way, that when the developers come in and the architects and they completely change the physical fact of an area. You know, it's up to us to make sure that they don't change our imagination of the area. How we perceive it and how we feel about it is still up to us, and that's what the practice of walking can be about. I'd like to read an email that you received in a sort of almost traditional radio show type manner. We were virtually begging for emails on the last show because we haven't received any. And then Nigel Smith sent us this, not just sent us an email, sent us a great email. I shall read it now very quickly. He says, I've long been interested in and enjoyed reading the writings of those such as S.P.B. Mays. I used to sell second-hand books in an old shop, and these books used to sit on the shelves, rarely selling, which is a shame, because they're interesting in their different social attitudes. I can't remember which writer it was, but he stumbled on some village boys bathing nude in the river and commented that there was nothing better than taking off all his clothes and joining them. There you go. And he also mentions in the email that he knows one of the current generation of Bones, who we'd like to hear from, wouldn't we? We'd like to hear from people like that.
Hmm. Interested in that, the boys bathing nude. It brings to mind an article published in The Express in the 1930s about the Order of Woodcraft Chivalry, a proto-New Age Boy Scout type movement who used to meet at Sandy Balls in the New Forest every summer. And they were exposed in The Express for allowing young boys to run around naked in the rhododendrons at Sandy Balls.
Wonderful. Well, we haven't got very long now. We've got another minute, so I think we should just say our thank yous. Thank you to you for listening, for a start. Please do email us at deeplibrary@yahoo.com. We've got a website, venturesintopography.wordpress.com. There's a podcast of this show, which comes out on a Wednesday, I think. So the first three are now available, first three episodes. Next week, we'll be doing The Story of Roxeth by, who's the author of that, Nick?
T.J. Bartlett. Roxeth is South Harrow, don't forget.
There you go, a bit of South Harrow yobbery coming through there. Thank you to Heidi LePain for her wonderful readings. Thank you to Michael here for driving the deck very expertly, because we were busking it, I have to say. We were just playing audio clips in left, right and centre. And have we got time to play out in a little clip, Michael? I'm going to play out a very short clip of us
finding that we are near the Ossulston 100, because it's a very short clip. Actually, no, I'm going to change my mind. I'm going to play something about St Pancras Old Church. Here we go.
There's something on. Church of England. Now, listen, I might make a fool of myself, because I try and learn about church architecture, but I always forget. But has this got Saxon elements in it?
Well, I don't know. We could look it up in the old London Compendium, but I think the story of St Pancras Old Church is that they think the fact that it's the oldest church in possibly one of the oldest churches in the world, actually.
Really?
The foundations, but most of this is, I think, is Gothic or Norman. Knocking on the door, there's lights on in the church, the gate's open. Is there a side entrance?
I think it's a fantastic place. Strangely enough, whenever I walk around here, particularly at this sort of time of year, I have this kind of imaginary 1970s, some rather fey-looking young man with a scarf and long hair who walks around and then goes home to listen to LPs that have never been made but kind of exist in my head. And they're the sort of pure 1970s folk, not so much prog rock as underground type music, just albums that were never made, and I've spent my